The way I describe it for people is my dad shot himself and the bullet hit everyone in his life. It was a week before my 30th birthday and I had this impulse to call him, but I didn't because I thought I could call him later that week.
63 Americans a day die by gun suicide. With safe gun storage, we can give our loved ones a second chance at life. Learn more at endfamilyfire.org. Brought to you by Brady and the Ad Council.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
My mother taught me to read when I was three, even though she mostly only, as growing up, wanted us to read things that were produced by the Jehovah's Witnesses, mm-hmm. but she taught me to read. And so by the time I went to kindergarten, I was well ahead of the kids in the public school system. And teachers recognized that, so they just kept skipping me ahead. But the backlash to that was that I was much younger than all of the children that I was in class with. And so I had no ability to connect to them, no relationship with them. And none of them could connect to me. I was just a little kid. And not only that, but I was a little kid, I was a smart kid, and the teachers liked me. So being skipped ahead with nothing else around me, no other support, really just left me more vulnerable to being bullied or anything else by the older kids I was in class with.
Lisa Forbes, author of I Can Take It From Here, a memoir of trauma, prison, and self-empowerment, published by Steel Force Press. As the youngest of six children, Forbes grew up in a Chicago housing project where she endured sexual, religious, and emotional abuse as a young girl. A voracious reader, she graduated high school at 15, went to work as a secretary in a downtown insurance office, she became pregnant at 16, and at 19, unexpectedly and uncharacteristically committed a violent act, stabbing and killing the father of her daughter. Forbes spent 14 years in prison. There she obtained a college degree and professional certificates. She also discovered writers like Shakespeare, Huey P. Newton, and Toni Morrison. Upon her release, she faced the same obstacles to a normal life many restored citizens face, the lack of job opportunities and affordable housing. I'm John L. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America and the beginning of our 52nd season. On this week's program, I Can Take It From Here with Lisa Forbes, In Black America.
Somebody pulled back the curtain and closed it back. I just thought, I don't think that was him. And it wasn't him that came to the window. But I said to myself, even if he would leave me out there, I didn't think he would leave his two-year-old out there in the Chicago winter. It was December. Mm-hmm. And so I thought something must be wrong there. And so I went. At that point, I had what I just could only call an irresistible impulse to get in the house and ironically think I was thinking maybe something bad was happening to him, something that maybe I would need to protect myself and him from whoever it was that had peeked out of that house. And so I walked to the Jewel grocery store a couple of blocks away, and I bought a couple of things to, you know, for my daughter to eat, but I also bought a knife.
Buying that knife was one of the biggest mistakes Lisa Forbes could have made. That decision led to a 14-year-long stint in a maximum security prison in Dixon, Illinois. But her trauma didn't begin there. An older brother sexually molested her for years. Her sisters bullied her. Her father drank. And her mother talked about the last days. Forbes did her best to ignore or suppress her rage and pain. In her book, I Can Take It From Here, Forbes provides powerful insight into what we as society need to learn and confront in the ongoing epidemic of mass reincarceration. She is a stunning example of an individual who, through determination, knowledge, and hard work, has been able to reclaim her own life. It hasn't been easy. Forbes grew up poor on the south side of Chicago, the youngest of six children, and at time in her 30s, she started her own company, Lisa Forbes, Inc., to help restored citizens cope with post-prison life. Recently in Black America spoke with Lisa Forbes.
Well, it was a journey. You know, it was interesting because I lived in multiple worlds. I had the world that I lived in my apartment where, you know, it was Jehovah's Witnesses. We're in this bubble. We don't associate with anybody. We don't do any bad things. And then inside of that bubble, everything bad was happening to me.
Mm-hmm.
But then outside of that was this world that was being projected that, you know, it was going to be destroyed at any minute. Armageddon was going to come. We just need to huddle together and, you know, try to survive it and not associate with other people. So it's all these different worlds I had to try to survive in, and most of them collided with each other. When I went to grammar school, I had teachers who saw my potential, and so they would bring me books to read and things and try to show an interest in me, but there was no support for that from my family. So it was a lot of different worlds to try to negotiate as a kid who had no coping skills at all, of course, because I was a kid.
Also understand that there were some trauma that was being inflicted on you. First, I want to talk to you about, you used to babysit a young lady who was murdered in one of the elevator shafts, correct?
Yes. So there was a woman who used to go to the Kingdom Hall with my mother.
Mm-hmm.
She had two young daughters, and I used to babysit her kids. And one day, I remember coming home from school and being told that she had been killed. And just nobody was really talking to me directly about what was going on because I was, you know, a little kid. But just hearing the other adult conversations describe what was going on, I heard about the injuries that had been inflicted on her, how,
mm-hmm.
you know, she had been stabbed in the throat and body was thrown down the elevator shaft, and just all of these horrible descriptions. And, you know, we think that sometimes when we're talking that kids are not listening to us or they're not being affected by what we say, but for years after that, first of all, I had trouble going into elevators.
Mm-hmm.
And then secondly, I had trouble holding my head back. Like if I would go to a salon or something and get my hair done and they would say, lean back over the bowl, I could barely do it because I felt like something was going to happen with my throat. I had to hold my hand over my throat. It would literally always stay with me that somebody could possibly stab you in the throat. And so I just had all of these things where there was really exposure to severe trauma and then no protection from it and no awareness from the adults around me that kids are listening to you and being affected by what you're describing. So that stayed with me for years. I mean, literally, I was an adult and I would still think about that woman every single day. She just lived in my energy system. The trauma that had happened to her got absorbed by me.
I also understand you were a pretty smart kid. You skipped, first and seventh grade?
I did. Because I had been, my mother taught me to read when I was three, even though she mostly only, as growing up, wanted us to read things that were produced by the Jehovah's Witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
But she taught me to read. And so by the time I went to kindergarten, I was well ahead of the kids in the public school system. And teachers recognized that, so they just kept skipping me ahead. But the backlash to that was that I was much younger than all of the children that I was in class with. And so I had no ability to connect to them, no relationship with them. And none of them could connect to me. So I was just a little kid. And not only that, but I was a little kid, I was a smart kid, and the teachers liked me. So being skipped ahead with nothing else around me, no other support, really just left me more vulnerable to being bullied or anything else by the older kids I was in class with.
Now, understand that you could have gone to Martin Luther King High School, but you ended up going to Dunbar, which was, I guess, closer to home?
Well, actually, it was the reverse.
Okay.
I wanted to go to Dunbar, which was a better school, mm-hmm. had a better reputation, but I would have had to take the bus every day to school. And my mother just said, that's not an option. You got to go to school where you can walk. And besides, all the other kids are going to King High School, and, you know, who do you think you are? So I went to, having graduated from eighth grade when I was 11, I went to the neighborhood school just a couple of blocks away, and it was just throughout the city understood to just be a terribly underperforming school, and really just got almost no education out of that school, and just filled with children who really were not literate. The teachers were not concerned, to the point where one of the administrators in the school called me down to the office one day because she looked at my birth date and she thought they must have had the wrong information. And she said, you know, she said, you're actually 12? Because I was 12 years old at that point in ninth grade. And I said, yeah. And she said to the other teacher standing around, she said, if my child was 12 years old and already in high school, I would sure have them in a better place than this. But that wasn't a thing that my mother even would consider, because to her it was irrelevant, because it doesn't matter what kind of education you're getting now. If Armageddon is going to come at any minute now, that's what we need to be focused on. So you don't need worldly knowledge anyway. So it was irrelevant to her what school I went to.
Give us an idea, because I think a lot of the audience don't understand the type of neighborhood that you had to walk through. Give our audience an idea of the things you had to walk past just to get to school every morning.
Well, it was we lived in the projects, so and it was a cluster of tall 16-story housing projects, and urine-soaked, dark, you know, the lights and the stairs were always busted out. We lived on the sixth floor, so we always had to walk up and down six flights of stairs because the elevators were broken 90% of the time. Gunshots day and night, gangs, people standing around, you know, just like, you know, grown men hanging out on the corner all day long. You're walking by them. Dark alleys. It's just really a situation where you would think if a person had any chance to get out of it, you know, they had a smart kid or whatever, that they would have had some thought. Let me not put my 12-year-old in a situation where this is where they're walking through, back and forth, and alone every day to go to school. And, you know, we hear a lot, so much about this now sometimes with the news in Chicago, mm-hmm. as if it's something new. But this is not new. Our kids have been having this trauma all along. And just so the constant fear. I remember being maybe 7 or 8 years old and hearing that one Halloween, was it Halloween? No, New Year's, when they were shooting, that a friend of mine who was, you know, also in grammar school got shot in the leg in her bed. A bullet came through the window. So, you know, this has been happening for decades where, we're living in these violent, traumatized, Wild West neighborhoods, and it's just presumed that you're going to grow up fine. Well, why would you?
You graduated, like you say, at 15 from high school. Mm-hmm. Everybody else going off to college, mm-hmm. mom and dad said, I don't think so, and you end up working downtown Chicago.
Right. So, you know, again, Armageddon is still not here yet, but mm-hmm. it's going to be coming any second now. So you don't need any more worldly knowledge. What you need is a job. So at 15, when I could have gone to any university probably in the world on a scholarship, my mother took me to get a work permit, and I became a clerk typist at an office in downtown Chicago. So I left every morning at 15 years old, going to work, took the bus and the train, and went to work as a clerk typist. And was surrounded by all of these adults. And again, I'm only 15 years old. I mean, most 15-year-olds are just going into high school. And this is what I'm doing, having already graduated from high school. And so it was on that job where I met my daughter's father. Within a few months of meeting him, I was pregnant at 16.
And Mr. Bankston promised to marry you. You didn't. You moved to Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. Came back that December. Mm-hmm. Went to the house. Tell us what happened.
Well, I always tell people that, you know, I accept full responsibility for what happened. I didn't write this book to try to justify myself, but to just simply to explain that what was caused by trauma, if I had met James Bankston or knocked on his door in December 1985 and had not already had a lifetime of trauma behind me, it would have been a completely different situation. But because it was, I always had, for instance, this fear. Well, even after the murder of Rhonda Sanders, being stabbed in the throat, I always had this feeling like death was near. Just this constant haunting that something bad, really bad, could happen to me. And of course, bad things had been happening to me every day in throughout my entire life. So I always had this fear, like I needed to be able to protect myself. And so when I knocked on his door and somebody pulled back the curtain and closed it back, I just thought, I don't think that was him. And it wasn't him that came to the window. But I said to myself, even if he would leave me out there, I didn't think he would leave his 2-year-old out there in the Chicago winter. It was December. Mm-hmm. And so I thought something must be wrong there. And so I went, at that point, I had what I just could only call an irresistible impulse to get in the house and ironically think, I was thinking maybe something bad was happening to him, something that maybe I would need to protect myself and him from whoever it was that had peeked out of that house. And so I walked to the Jewel grocery store a couple of blocks away, and I bought a couple of things to, you know, for my daughter to eat, but I also bought a knife. And I didn't even have the knife unwrapped. When I went back to his house and somebody opened the door who had been previously introduced to me by him as his cousin, but I found out after all of this happened that, in fact, she was his wife. When she let me in, I realized what was happening. And he really, John, it was just a case of the utter humiliation, the laughter, the mockery, all of the things that happened in that moment when I was thinking maybe something was wrong with him and maybe I need to get in there and find out and see if I could help him. What happened was simply that in that moment, I just projected a lifetime of trauma onto a single individual and just punished him for my whole life. The situation, there were people there that I didn't know who they were. He was laughing at me. People were standing around. And I just really, at that moment, just had an emotional breakdown. And that is really what happened. So when people say, why didn't you make a different decision? Why didn't you just turn around and leave? I was a teenager, still then, who had been so traumatized throughout my entire life that I could only make the decisions that my traumatized mind would allow me to make. And so I responded violently, I responded, you know, irrationally, inappropriately, and I tell people if I had been on my jury, I would have convicted me too, because none of them heard anything about my life. But what caused that moment was an emotional breakdown caused by trauma. And there's no way to explain it logically. It's the only way to explain it is in the context of what my entire life had been like.
1987, you're convicted of the offense. You go off to the White Correctional Center in Dixon, Illinois. Tell us, what was it like that first day that you spent night in the penitentiary?
Well, that first night, I used to have these constant feelings of, like, this is a dream. Mm. I used to be in a dreamlike state a lot of times, like things are not real. So I spent probably the first few days just feeling like this is not actually happening. And then finally I started settling into, okay, they put you through quarantine and all these things, and the psychologist comes back and says, you're not a typical you know, inmate. Well, you know, gee, thanks. That's not really helpful. but you know, so I finally had to just focus on the fact that my appellate, a public defender, was saying I had a really great cause for an appeal. There had been several things that had gone wrong with the trial. Some of them the judge had even acknowledged. She said it might take a while. Things are really backed up, but don't worry. I'm really confident you're gonna win your appeal. And so after a while, that just became my lifeline. I just lived for the thought that, hey, I'm not gonna do this time. I'm gonna get out.
I found it amazing that your court-appointed attorney eventually became a judge.
Yep.
It is just totally amazing, considering all the missteps that he had in your defense.
Mm-hmm. He became a judge, and you know, it was as if it was like the beat goes on. So when people talk now about, you know, people being found factually innocent, or you know, and even though I may not have been factually innocent, but when people talk about how people are coming off of death row, being found out that it could not have been them, DNA exonerates them. People really need to understand that this is not a new thing. This has been like business as usual in the Black community for forever, where with people who are supposed to be representing us or judging our situation just have no interest whatever in defending us. It's just like pigs on a slaughter, and then you just have to spend the rest of your life trying to prove what happened. And that's kind of what happened with my trial public defender. He just basically had no, I mean, there were times when I could tell he could barely remember my name.
And also, go ahead.
He goes through, and it's so business as usual that he just goes through his job performance and eventually gets promoted to judge.
I found it interesting that the initials public defender, PD, relates to penitentiary delivery. That's what they told
you. My mother was like, well, we're not going to raise any money for a private attorney because, you know, we were told that a public defender would be just as good. And I was like, oh, my God, you can't be serious, you know. But it's one of those things that you just don't understand what's happening until you're on the backside of it.
I understand. If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio, and speaking with Lisa Forbes, founder and CEO of Lisa Forbes, Inc., and author of I Can Take It From Here, a memoir of trauma, prison, and self-empowerment. Lisa, what brought you to the decision that you were going to try to escape from prison?
Well, as I said, my lifeline that I had been holding on to was the certainty of my appellate defender that I was going to win the appeal. When I saw the reasons that I didn't, it wasn't that the appellate court said none of these inappropriate things happened. The appellate court literally said that there were about four or five things that happened in my trial and sentencing that should not have happened, but it really didn't matter because it wouldn't have changed things anyway.
Wow.
When I saw that reasoning, I said, okay, I'm never going to get out of here, and there's no way I'm going to do all this time. And so, you know, I didn't know how to get out legally at that point, but I felt like I knew how to climb a fence, right? But the thing is, if you look at it, that really was just a continuation of a traumatic state because I had no plan, no anything. I guess I was just going to climb this fence and walk to Chicago. But that is really the continuation of, you know, one thing I want to say, John, is that something that people don't often factor in, the prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain that is responsible for reason and judgment, is not fully formed until people are in their early 20s. And that's why you really shouldn't teenagers should be looked at differently in the criminal justice system, because when the prefrontal cortex is still not formed, when you ask a person why you did something, when they look back on it as an adult, there is no rational answer for that. I did that because I have no idea. Even I know it doesn't make sense now. But at the time, it seemed like a great idea. you know. But I had no plan, no anything. My entire thing was, these people are not going to let me out, so I'm going to let myself out.
Now, when you attempted the escape, obviously you injured yourself, so at some point, authorities are going to know what you attempted to do, correct?
Correct. So I fell back. I got to the top of the fence, got all cut up, sliced up by the razor wire, lost my balance, and I fell back from the top of the fence, landed on my back, and shattered my left ankle.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, I know I'm not going anywhere, but I've got to get to the hospital now. So I dragged myself to the road where I could be seen by the passing patrol car and actually flagged her down when she drove by, and I just knew then that it was over and I had to get to a hospital. And so from there, the first guard who saw me thought I had been attacked. So she took me to the hospital inside the prison, and then called the warden, and they told them I needed to be transported to the outside hospital. But when the warden came, she took one look at me, and she did not think I had been attacked. She said, "Lisa, you and that fence cannot tango."
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, she was a little more astute than the guard. She recognized what had happened. And so after that, I did go out to the outside hospital, and I had surgery. And actually, the surgeon told me that I was probably going to limp for the rest of my life. But I didn't, and that was really the first time I realized that I could use my mind to help myself.
Now, you did your 14 years and you were released from prison. Talk mm-hmm. to us about that.
Well, I came out, and I went to the Safer Foundation, which is a place that was well known throughout the Illinois Department of Corrections for helping people find jobs when they get out. You know, they give you this manual when you go through the pre-release program, and, you know, it's got all these places and numbers to call. You think, okay, I've got some support. So I'm going through this manual. Most of these places don't exist anymore. The numbers don't work. You know, it's really just a sham. But I went to the Safer Foundation because I've got a little resume. I'm thinking, well, I've at least been a secretary before. And unlike most of the people who were incarcerated who are not literate, I was able to read and write. And so I'm thinking, surely they're going to help me. And when I get there, they tell me they are not allowed to work with me because the prison put it on my release papers that I needed therapy before I could go into the workforce.
And I'm thinking, your way.
I've been sitting in your day room for 14 years. If you thought I needed therapy, why didn't you give it to me then? And so to add insult to injury, they gave me then a list of places to go to get therapy. One of them happened to be a couple of blocks from where I was staying with my parents.
Right.
So I went back home, walked to that place, and they tell me, no, you're not in our district.
Lisa Forbes, author of I Can Take It From Here, a memoir of trauma, prison, and self-empowerment. We will conclude our conversation on next week's program. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's americanarchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm John L. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today as we begin our 52nd season, and please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs. KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs. KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio. From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
When I had originally gotten the apartment, I was still using my married name because I hadn't changed it yet.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, for whatever reason, even with the Social Security number, it didn't come up as with any criminal conviction. So I got the apartment. But after, you know, and I started buying things and really feeling like I was settling in. I finally had a little job as a receptionist at a law firm, though, at this time. So I was at a law firm and just feeling good about myself. And I decided, okay, I'm going to go back to my maiden name because this is part of how I'm reclaiming myself,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm claiming my own name. So I want to go to get a larger apartment because I had a one-bedroom. And I was thinking, you know, my daughter could come stay with me sometimes. She'd have her own bedroom. So I applied to get a two-bedroom apartment. And they told me that even if it's a current tenant, when you apply for a larger apartment or a different apartment, they process your application just like you were a new applicant. And so by that time, my name was back to Lisa Forbes. And when they ran it that time, my 20-something-year-old conviction came up.
Lisa Forbes, author of I Can Take It From Here, a memoir of trauma, prison, and self-empowerment, published by Steel Force Press. As the youngest of six children, Forbes grew up in a Chicago housing project where she endured sexual, religious, and emotional abuse as a young girl. A voracious reader, she graduated high school at 15, went to work as a secretary in a downtown insurance office. She became pregnant at 16, and at 19, unexpectedly and uncharacteristically, committed a violent act, stabbing and killing the father of her daughter. Ford spent 14 years in prison. There she obtained a college degree and professional certificates. She also discovered writers like Shakespeare, Huey P. Newton, and Toni Morrison. Upon her release, she faced the same obstacles to a normal life many restored citizens face, the lack of job opportunities and affordable housing. I'm John L. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America and the beginning of our 52nd season. On this week's program, I Can Take It From Here with Lisa Forbes in Black America.
Well, there are many studies that show that the majority of people who are incarcerated were traumatized as children. And while it may not be, while it is true that not every traumatized person goes on to go to prison, the majority of people there having experienced trauma as childhood is too significant a statistic to be ignored. And so traumatized people cannot. Again, as I said, I could only make the decision that my mind would allow me to make. Traumatized people are in that state everywhere. You think that, oh, I'm going to help you get a job. I'm going to help you get an apartment. This is reentry. But if a person is dealing with unprocessed trauma, you can give them a job, but can they keep a job?
Buying that knife was one of the biggest mistakes Lisa Forbes could have made. That decision led to a 14-year-long stint in a maximum security prison in Dixon, Illinois. But her trauma didn't begin there. An older brother sexually molested her for years. Her sisters bullied her. Her father drank. And her mother talked about the last days. Forbes did her best to ignore or suppress her rage and pain. In her book, I Can Take It From Here, Forbes provide powerful insight into what we as society need to learn and confront and the ongoing epidemic of mass reincarceration. She is a stunning example of an individual who, through determination, knowledge, and hard work, has been able to reclaim her own life. It hasn't been easy. Forbes grew up poor on the south side of Chicago, the youngest of six children. An ex-con in her 30s, she started her own company, Lisa Forbes, Inc., to help restored citizens cope with post-prison life. Recently, In Black America spoke with Lisa Forbes.
But when the warden came, she took one look at me and she did not think I had been attacked. She said, Lisa, you and that fence cannot tango. So, you know, she was a little more astute than the guard. She recognized what had happened. And so after that, I did go out to the outside hospital, and I had surgery. And actually, the surgeon told me that I was probably going to limp for the rest of my life. But I didn't, and that was really the first time I realized that I could use my mind to help myself.
Now, you did your 14 years and you were released from prison. Talk to us about that.
Well, I came out, and I went to the Safer Foundation, which is a place that was well known throughout the Illinois Department of Corrections for helping people find jobs when they get out. You know, they give you this manual when you go through the pre-release program, and, you know, it's got all these places and numbers to call. You think, okay, I've got some support. So I'm going through this manual. Most of these places don't exist anymore. The numbers don't work. You know, it's really just a sham. But I went to the Saber Foundation because I've got a little resume. I'm thinking, well, I've at least been a secretary before. And unlike most of the people who were incarcerated who are not literate, I was able to read and write. And so I'm thinking, surely they're going to help me. And when I get there, they tell me they are not allowed to work with me because the prison put it on my release papers that I needed therapy before I could go into the workforce.
And I'm thinking,
I've been sitting in your day room for 14 years. If you thought I needed therapy, why didn't you give it to me then? And so to add insult to injury, they gave me then a list of places to go to get therapy. One of them happened to be a couple of blocks from where I was staying with my parents.
Right.
So I went back home, walked to that place, and they tell me, no, you're not in our district. The district you're in is on the other side of town, which was like an hour bus ride. And I said, how can I not be in your district when I just walked here a couple of blocks? We don't know. We're sorry, but that you're not in our district. Well, how can I make, and I had to go, they said I had to go three times a week. I'm like, how can I go an hour bus ride three times a week if I'm not working and I don't have bus fare? I don't know. We're sorry. That's what your paperwork says. So that's when I really realized, okay, this book of places to go and get help is really a joke. And if it was not for my own ability to have some workaround for that, that would have stopped me right there because none of those places would work with me because of my charge. Most of them would only help nonviolent offenders or drug offenders, and because the DOC had said she needs therapy first. My mouth was hanging open.
I know it was. Lisa, I found it interesting that obviously you must have stayed in shape because you did a lot of walking.
I did.
Talk to our audience about having the fortitude and the stick-to-itiveness to get up, walk, take buses to the jobs that you were basically overqualified for.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing was, I determined that one thing I told myself, even while I was in and definitely when I got out, I kept saying to myself, this is not who I am. I am not who these people are saying that I am, and I'm not going to be who they're saying I'm going to be, and I'm not going back. You know, when I left, when I was the day I was paroled, as I was walking out the gate, one of the guards waved at me and said, see you later.
You don't think so.
And I said, no, you won't. And then they laughed. But that was just, it's like a common thing. In the 14 years I was there, I saw the same people coming in and out, like a revolving door. And so I really just realized that if I was going to get anywhere, I was going to have to do it for myself, make no excuses. And that's really what gave me the fortitude to just take whatever job I could take. I just kept saying, something has got to turn around because I know this is not who I am. And that's what gave me the energy to walk through thunderstorms and snowstorms and everything else to go take minimum wage jobs, even though in prison I had gotten associate's degrees and a paralegal certificate. I was taking minimum wage jobs, pushing little mail buggies around mm-hmm. the office because that was all I could get.
Now, you moved to Atlanta. You met another man that was 37 years your senior, and he mm-hmm. did you wrong also. Talk to us about that experience.
Actually, I met him in Illinois. He was the Muslim
right.
chaplain in
exactly.
the prison.
Mm-hmm.
And so after 14 years of being incarcerated, I was out for 9 months. And then I married him because I saw it, I thought, as a way of getting some security and getting some safety. It seemed like a good idea at the time. And so, but when after we got married, I'm the youngest of six children. And I realized after we got married that I had just married a man who was my father's age and who had five older children younger than me. And it became crystal clear that I was right back in my childhood. I had literally just recreated my childhood, and he was treated me just like my mother had. He was a combination of my mother and my father, and his children were a combination of my older siblings. I had literally just recreated my childhood, and when I realized how almost down to the last detail I had just put myself right back in a loop, that's mm-hmm. when I realized that I'm stuck in a feedback loop. I need to figure out how to break this cycle.
Now, there was an upside. You all purchased a house. You got your new car.
Mm-hmm.
And you were able to give Mercedes her own vehicle once you got on you all's feet. How did that feel?
Oh, I felt like I had hit the jackpot in the beginning. So I was able to finally do something for my daughter. And, mm-hmm. you know, I was living in the best situation I had ever lived in my life. I had never lived in a house. You know, we had a brand new car. I felt like, okay, I'm good now. I'd hit the jackpot. But that, John, is the way why I say when I talk about trauma or talk about prison, you don't have to be behind bars to be in a prison. You can be in prison in your house. You can be in prison in your relationship. So when this book talks about trauma, it's not just directed to people in prison, in a physical prison, because I realized I was right back in prison in that marriage, in a circumstance, though, that in the beginning looked like it was going to be a salvation. It turned into a nightmare. It turned into a prison.
So once you got a divorce, did you move back to Chicago prior to moving to Colorado?
I did. I went back to my parents and just realized how it was like going back and through a time warp. People were having the same conversations, doing the same things, having the same arguments, having the same complaints, the same no money, watching the same TV shows. It was like I had gone back in time. And I just realized that this is not my idea of freedom. But I was grateful to have somewhere to go back to, mm-hmm. but I knew I could only stay there for a short period of time because there was no life for me there either. And what I was looking for was not just to be free to walk the streets, but to be free indeed, to be free to restore my life to what I felt like it could be. So I stayed with them just for a couple of months, and then I moved to Denver, where I am now.
Now, before we get into depth about, I think, the best part of the book, which is Lisa Forbes, Inc., talk to us about your living at the Parliament Apartments.
Mm-hmm.
Had a full-time job. Mm-hmm. You decided to use your maiden name from your married name, been at the apartment for 2 years. Mm-hmm. They did a background check with your maiden name and then told you had to leave because you had a criminal record.
Right. When I had originally gotten the apartment, I was still using my married name because I hadn't changed it yet.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, for whatever reason, even with the Social Security number, it didn't come up as with any criminal conviction. So I got the apartment, you know, and I started buying things and really feeling like I was settling in. I finally had a little job as a receptionist at a law firm, though, at this time. So I was at a law firm and just feeling good about myself. And I decided, okay, I'm going to go back to my maiden name because this is part of how I'm reclaiming myself,
mm-hmm,
you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm claiming my own name. So I want to go to get a larger apartment because I had a one-bedroom. And I was thinking, you know, my daughter could come stay with me sometime. She'd have her own bedroom. So I applied to get a two-bedroom apartment. And they told me that even if it's a current tenant, when you apply for a larger apartment or a different apartment, they process your application just like you were a new applicant. And so by that time, my name was back to Lisa Forbes. And when they ran at that time, my 20-something-year-old conviction came up. And they called me and said, this is not happening, and it gave me 72 hours to get out. And I did not have anywhere to go. I did not have a car. I did not have anywhere to put my things. I really just had to throw everything I had bought into the dumpster, and I moved into an extended living motel.
And I found it interesting that the rent that you were paying at the motel was more than what you were paying at the apartment.
It was.
That's
so
crazy.
So it wasn't, it was, I mean, so it really is just another way in which, you know, the poor get gouged even more. The mm-hmm. worse position you're in, the more you pay for everything. So, yeah, that little room that I had to live in
right.
was more than an entire apartment.
And
but
you,
I had to pay, it was either that or sleep on a bench.
I understand. And you talk about that was one of the reasons that you started Lisa Inc. But before we get to Lisa Forbes Inc., why was it important for you to register to vote once you returned as a restored citizen?
It was again just one of the ways in which I wanted to establish my own identity. Mm-hmm. So Jehovah's Witnesses don't vote. So I had been told, you know, God doesn't want you to vote. Don't get involved in this worldly system. It was one way of my saying I'm here. I'm in the society. I want to have a voice, and I want to be my own person. And so just I wanted to do those things. And another thing that I feel about voting is a lot of people say it doesn't make any difference. Voting was important to me because of the price other people had paid for me to be able to vote. So I wanted to acknowledge that. I had done a lot of reading about the Civil Rights Movement and Black Panther Party and all these things that I talk about in the book, in the chapter, The Education of Lisa Forbes. And I had really gotten to understand what other people had tried to do to get us to a certain point of being able to function in society. And I figured if people had laid down their lives in order for me to be able to vote, the very mm-hmm. least I could do was vote. So that was important to me.
Now let's talk about Lisa Forbes. You mm-hmm. obviously talk a lot about trauma. Talk to our audience about the trauma that most ex-offenders go through that aren't really addressed, which keeps them in a perpetual cycle of incarceration.
Well, there are many studies that show that the majority of people who are incarcerated were traumatized as children. And while it may not be, while it is true that not every traumatized person goes on to go to prison, the majority of people there having experienced trauma as childhood is too significant a statistic to be ignored. And so traumatized people cannot, again, as I said, I could only make the decision that my mind would allow me to make. Traumatized people are in that state everywhere. You think that, oh, I'm going to help you get a job. I'm going to help you get an apartment. This is reentry. But if a person is dealing with unprocessed trauma, you can give them a job, but can they keep a job? Or the first time their employer says something to them, are they going to go berserk? Are they going to have a flashback? You know, you can give them an apartment, but can they keep an apartment? Or is their trauma in control of their decisions that is part of the what is fueling recidivism? And it is. I knew that it was my own trauma that was keeping me stuck in this loop of making bad decisions. So my bad decisions wasn't to go back to drugs. But for a lot of people, that their trauma and their pain is what's connected them to their addiction, you know. Or they have children that they're trying to get back, and they can't get them. That you have all these additional loopholes. For instance, if you have children taken from you when you're incarcerated, let's say you're a single parent and you have a boy and a girl. Well, you need a three-bedroom apartment because your boy needs his bedroom. Mm-hmm. The girl can't share a bedroom with the boy, so she needs a bedroom, and neither one of them can share a bedroom with you. So you need a three-bedroom apartment just because you've been to prison. Otherwise, if parents all over the place are in one-bedroom apartments with their little kids. But all these little ways in which the state puts these additional layers of requirements on you that people don't realize that restored citizens are laboring under. And so people come out, how do you get a three-bedroom apartment with a minimum wage job? So they never get their kids. Or their literacy rate is so low that they can't ever get a job above minimum wage. So I just really began to see that not only did I have my own trauma, but I began to see that in some ways other people actually had some issues that they had no way of even dealing with because of a lack of literacy. And it really just forced me to say, okay, if I could see this, I need other people to be able to understand that reentry is we need to address jobs and housing, but the underlying root of a lot of the things that we're dealing with as separate issues is the fact that they're being connected by the underlying trauma. So that became my focus. What should we really focus on to not just say reentry, but really to break the cycle of recidivism? You don't break that cycle if you don't address unresolved trauma.
You also talk about health. Mm-hmm. And restored citizens come out, and they have minimum wage jobs, mm-hmm. which doesn't allow them to eat healthy. How does that perpetual system and lifestyle affect them long term when they're not eating healthy? And if they have children, the children are definitely not eating healthy. They're continually eating fast foods.
Exactly. Well, one of the things that we also know as a society, the studies have been done, but it's not widely discussed, is that there is a connection between malnutrition and crime. There is a connection between not having a certain amount of nutrients going to the brain and people and children's brains and teenagers' brains not being able to form correctly. And again, it goes back to that prefrontal cortex, that judgment center. So we know that there is a connection between the sugary diets, the high-fat diets, the high-salt diets, and the fact that the brain tends to have more violent tendencies. Those studies are actually out there. And so it's really important to understand that this is a multi-pronged issue that when we're dealing with, well, why people do what they do, why do they commit crimes, why do they go back, there are so many factors in it. But it is, in fact, even though there are factors in it that seem to not be related, many of them are tied together by just one or two threads. Even while I was in Denver still, mm-hmm. while I was living at Motel 6, we couldn't get an apartment, and again, paying more than what an apartment would have, I basically would pick up lunch at McDonald's, dinner at Burger King, you know, skip breakfast. It was because that was what I could afford. And so now when you see people trying to feed two or three kids on it's what they can afford, but it's not what the brain needs to be healthy.
Before we run out of time, Lisa, talk to us about shifting baseline syndrome.
Shifting baseline syndrome is something that used to be applied to the environment, but I wanted to show that the same logic applied to people. Whereas the issue is, what do you consider normal? So if you look 50 years ago at what we considered normal and compare it to what we consider normal today, it has dropped so dramatically. And we aren't asking ourselves why. I remember I was reading the book, Hidden Figures, and the author said, when I was growing up, I saw so many black doctors and scientists and engineers and mathematicians, I just thought that was what black people were. So what happened? How did we go from somebody raised in an environment where she just thought black people were naturally mathematicians, black people just naturally worked at NASA, they were engineers, to today, black people just naturally can't pass a math test. Mm-hmm. Black people just naturally can't read. Like, how did this become our norm? Shifting baseline syndrome is when the baseline for what you consider normal behavior or normal results shifts so imperceptibly downward over a period of time that you don't realize you're lowering your standards for what's normal. And what you're considering normal today, 50 years ago, you would have been a freak. We really need to readdress what we consider to be normal for black people.
Ms. Ford, what do you want readers to come away with once they read the book?
I want readers to, first of all, begin to have a conversation about the trauma that they have faced in their lives. If you can't address your trauma, you can never resolve it. And if you can't resolve it, you can't break the chains that trauma has on you, keeping you tied to repeating your past. So that's the first thing. The second thing I want people to come away with is to know that there are simple tools to address trauma. If I had had to have a high-paying job and insurance and go talk to somebody, you know, I would have never gotten the help I needed. I discovered the emotional freedom technique when I was laid off with no money in a house in pre-foreclosure, and I just got on the internet and found a tool that helped myself. So I want people to realize there are tools that can help you to help yourself and get you to the point where you can be free from trauma, not just released from prison, whatever your prison is, whether it's behind walls or in your house. There are ways for you to free yourself that I know worked because they worked for me.
Any final comments, Ms. Forbes?
Well, I really just want to talk about what the term restored citizens means to me. I took that from the Bible. There's a scripture in the Bible where God says he will restore to you the years that the locust and the cankerworm and the caterpillar ate up. And when I read that scripture sitting in my cell, I claimed that for myself. I said, I want my life restored. And that's why I use the term restored citizens. A lot of people talk about returning citizens, but I've seen people go out of prison and then return back to prison. So I didn't want to be returning. I wanted to get out and have my life restored to what I was truly capable of being had I not suffered the trauma that I experienced. And that's what I want for other people to grasp, that you can have your life restored. You're not totally permanently messed up because of anything you've done. Your life can be restored to what it's truly capable of being.
Lisa Forbes, author of I Can Take It From Here, A Memoir of Trauma, Prison, and Self-Empowerment. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's americanarchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm John L. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today as we begin our 52nd season, and please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio. If you're talking, they
will hear you. We all want our kids to grow up safe and healthy. So we show them how. And we tell them with honest conversations that let them know what we expect. Not just one time, but every chance we get. That's especially important when it comes to alcohol and other drugs. Kids not only need to know the dangers and how to avoid them, they need to hear it often from you. And when it comes to pain medications, opioids, they need to know that they should never be taken without a prescription and never shared with friends or family. It's dangerous and illegal. So talk with your kids and guide them through the challenges of growing up safe and healthy. Because when you talk, they hear you. For more information about talking with your kids about underage use of alcohol and other drugs, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov. So don't they hear you? You can
do it if you try. When it comes to vaping, the truth can get clouded. So let's make it clear. Vaping is not safe for kids, teens, or young adults. It's just not.
Because vaping can put microscopic particles into your lungs.
And dangerous things like metals and volatile organic compounds into your body.
And nicotine, the same highly addictive substance found in regular cigarettes.
Nicotine can harm a person's brain development through their mid-20s.
Affecting learning, memory, attention, and impulse control. And priming the brain for other addictions.
Vaping products also come in kid-friendly flavors that can make them appealing to youth.
And many kids also use other drugs, like marijuana, in vaping devices.
With appealing flavors, high nicotine levels, and lots of promotion on social media,
many kids think vaping is harmless, but it's not.
So talk to your kids about the risks of vaping, because when you talk, they hear you.
For more information, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
WRCT, Pittsburgh. We'll be right back.